Good afternoon. My name is Chris, and I will be your conference operator today. At this time, I would like to welcome everyone to the Society Research Updates call. All lines have been placed on mute to prevent any background noise. After the speaker's remarks, there will be a question-and-answer session. If you would like to ask a question during this time, simply press star, then the number one on your telephone keypad. If you would like to withdraw your question, press the pound key. Thank you. Ms. Lee, you may begin your conference.
Great. Thank you, Chris. Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Heather Lee, and I am a member of the Society's National Development Team, and I'm delighted to welcome each of you to today's research update. As valued friends and supporters, we are eager to have you participate in what should be an engaging and exciting discussion with our Chief Research Officer, Dr. Timothy Kutze, and our Associate Vice President of Discovery Research, Dr. Bruce Bebo. I know many of you have had the chance to meet Dr. Kutze in the past, and perhaps Dr. Bebo as well, but let me start by providing just a brief update on their backgrounds. Dr. Kutze has been a leader in the pursuit of innovative ways to move us closer to a world free of multiple sclerosis since receiving his PhD in microbiology and immunology in 1993. Dr. Kutze has contributed to the field of MS research in numerous ways, from his postdoctoral research work researching the structure and function of myelin to ultimately helping to create programs such as the Society's Translational Research Partnerships in Nervous System Repair and Protection in MS and the Society's commercial research subsidiary, Fast Forward. As Chief Research Officer, Dr. Kutze is responsible for all of the Society's research programs, and he has demonstrated proven ability to create critical partnerships and effective collaborations worldwide to move research and treatment forward faster for people affected by all forms of MS. In his role as Associate Vice President of Discovery Research, Dr. Bruce Bebo directs the Society's diverse portfolio of biomedical research focused on stopping MS, restoring function, and ending the disease forever. Dr. Bebo came to the Society with 25 years of experience in biomedical research, including his own work investigating the role of hormones in immune responses to myelin. After receiving his PhD in immunology from Texas A&M, he completed a Society-sponsored postdoctoral fellowship at the Portland VA Medical Center and then served on the research faculty at Oregon Health and Science University. He has also worked in the pharmaceutical industry, translating laboratory research into better therapies for autoimmune and inflammatory diseases. Now, before I hand things over to Dr. Kutze and Dr. Bebo, I'd just like to let everyone know that there will be two separate opportunities during the call to pose any questions that you may have. When those times are made known, our operator, Chris, will instruct you on how to submit a question. So without further ado, I'd like to hand things over to Dr. Kutze.
Thank you, Heather, and thank you, everybody, for joining Bruce and I for this call today. It's always fun for Bruce and I to share what's exciting and what's happening in the world of MS research. As many of you probably know, I'm a bit of a nerd, and Bruce is right there with me, although he's much cooler than I am. And so we're going to have some fun talking with you about the stuff that excites us, and particularly in the context of the recently concluded ECTRIMS meetings. Some of you might be wondering, well, what is ECTRIMS? It's spelled out ECTRIMS. ECTRIMS stands for the European Committee on Treatment and Research in MS. And why we're here actually today to talk with you about that is that ECTRIMS, which is an umbrella organization created by researchers in Europe, actually has over the last 25 years also become the go-to annual meeting for MS researchers from around the world. It has become the world's largest gathering of MS researchers and physicians. This year, a number of us from the Society went to the ECTRIMS meeting, which was held in Copenhagen in Denmark. This meeting attracted close to 8,000 people, all focused on multiple sclerosis, which, you know, I think stop and think about that for a second. It's just remarkable that, you know, in one place you have so much amazing brain power, all dedicated to the range of MS research. We had, it was a science meeting, and so there's lots of science presented and discussed. You know, there were over 1,000 scientific presentations on various aspects of multiple sclerosis. One of the things that also happens at a big meeting like this is it's where scientists intersect and connect with each other to talk about their science, to build collaboration, for fellows to meet with potential mentors, for graduate students to learn what's the emerging area, and also for people with MS. There were a number of people with MS who participated to learn and hear about the latest research. And we go to events like this, and when I say we, the National MS Society team goes to ECTRIMS for several reasons. You know, one is we obviously want to stay abreast of the science. We work, at the home office, and we're distributed throughout the country. But, if you want to get a boots-on-the-ground perspective on what's happening in MS research, you can read about it in papers online, but you really need to go and interact with the scientists and see what's happening. We start early, start working around 7:30 in the morning, and go to late in the evening because there's lots of discussion. And so we're there to really dig deep into the science to hear the latest cutting-edge work. We've also, in recent years, taken it a step further. So rather than just being consumers of the science, we've also been blogging about what's happening and what's being highlighted. And so this year we had a couple of bloggers, one old blogger and a couple of new bloggers. We partnered with Julie Stachowiak, who is the major MS blogger. Julie lives with MS, has a PhD in epidemiology, and blogs about her experiences with multiple sclerosis on about.com. She's really a very thoughtful and insightful writer. And so Julie spent some time writing about what she saw. In addition, our own Bruce Bebo and Nick LaRocca as well, another member of the Society research team, blogged about what they found was what was exciting and interesting. And so I encourage you to visit the Society's blog, msconnection.org. And click on the blog link, and you'll be able to see some of what Bruce and Nick and Julie were writing about. The other things we do is we actually, because this is a large meeting, it brings together leadership from many of the companies that are involved in doing MS research, and so we meet with leaders from these pharmaceutical companies to both get updates on what they're thinking about and to talk about future partnership opportunities. And then the other thing we do is we engage in the global MS movement ourselves by participating in planning meetings of the International Pediatric MS Study Group, the Progressive MS Alliance, which we'll hear a little bit more about later. It's really meant as a way for us as leaders in the MS movement to also participate and to build collaborations with our peers at other MS societies like our own. It's a filled and productive time, and we're there for almost a week, and we came back with lots of both ideas about the new and exciting science, but also excited about the impact that the National MS Society was having globally. And as I mentioned, one of the things we do there is to take in the science and to hear about the latest things. And so that's why we asked Bruce, our Associate VP of Discovery Researcher, a longtime MS researcher himself, to come and share a little bit about that. So, Bruce, tell us what excited you about at the ECTRIMS meeting.
Happy to, Tim, and happy to be considered the cool science geek of the group. To me, that the highlights for this meeting were really the volume and sophistication of the research that's focused on the repair of the nervous system. So there were just so many abstracts, talks, presentations on strategies for repair, understanding repair, and in some cases failure to repair the nervous system and MS. One presentation I'd like to call out specifically was by an old friend of all of ours, Dr. Bruce Trapp, who's at the Cleveland Clinic and who's been studying MS for decades. And he had a presentation where he was focusing in on this particular kind of lesion that he's noticed in the nervous system of people with MS that's got the name intercortical. And what that intercortical means is that this is a lesion in the brain that overlaps the gray matter and the white matter. And it's one lesion, but part of it lives in the gray matter and part of it in the white matter. And it's important that it's one lesion because the assumption is that both sides of these of this one lesion started at the same time, so that they're the same age of lesion. So then let's look at the white matter side and let's look at the gray matter side and see what's different. And what he found was that on the white matter side, these were old lesions. They'd been around for a really long time. They're called chronic lesions. There was a lot of damage. There were cells that have the capacity to produce myelin in those lesions, and they're called oligodendrocyte precursor cells, or just OPCs for short. So they're in those lesions, but they can't make new myelin, and they're not repairing the white matter side of that lesion. When you look at the gray matter side of the lesion, you also see these OPC cells, these precursor cells for myelin-producing cells in the gray matter, but they're remyelinating. They're reaching out to axons. They're wrapping around them. They're creating new myelin robustly, even in lesions that are as old as 30 or 35 years. So there's a big difference between some of the lesions that occur in the gray matter and the white matter as far as repair. And there's something either favoring repair in the gray matter and or inhibiting repair in the white matter that keeps those white matter lesions from repairing themselves. So that that visualization of that was just really fascinating to me and interesting to me and easy to conceptualize. And so that group is beginning to look at what some of the differences are between the gray matter lesion and the white matter lesion. And one of the things they've found in collaboration with Dr. Larry Sherman at Oregon Health and Sciences University is that there's a sugar molecule that's made by the astrocytes, a certain cell in the nervous system, called hyaluronic acid. And there is a ton of this hyaluronic acid that's in the white matter. And Dr. Sherman and his colleagues have shown that this sugar molecule, this hyaluronic acid, can inhibit those myelin-producing precursors, those OPC cells, from remyelinating. And what he saw was there was virtually no hyaluronic acid in the gray matter. So that difference between the gray matter and the white matter could potentially be explained, at least in part, by the presence of this hyaluronic acid on the white matter side and lack of it on the gray matter side. So that's a story that remains to be completely solved, but I found that incredibly fascinating and that we can study in a single lesion where it's working, where it's repairing, and where it's not repairing. Go ahead. Sorry, Tim.
So let me just tease a couple of threads out. So
yeah.
What I think I hear you saying is, one, that old lesions are able to repair themselves, actually. So that's one thing that, you know, maybe punching a little hole in the dogma that it's only young lesions that can repair themselves, so that old lesions can repair themselves. So that's an important finding, it seems. But the other piece I think I hear you saying is that, you know, since myelin is what contributes to sort of the white matter, that the white portions of the brain, what I think I hear you saying is that myelin itself, which, you know, we normally think is a good thing, that in the context of lesions can actually get in the way of rebuilding basically the brain. Would that be a fair way to describe it?
Well, there's certainly something in the white matter, which is white because it contains myelin, which is a lipid-containing substance. There's definitely something in the white matter that's preventing those oligodendrocyte precursor cells, those OPCs, from remyelinating. What it is in the white matter that's doing that isn't clear. And this hyaluronic acid may be one part of that story, but undoubtedly there are other pieces to that story. So we may get to this. Well, we might as well get to it now. There's this the Lingo story, which could be potentially an explanation. This is a molecule that prevents or stops remyelination. It's present on oligodendrocytes and neurons, and this receptor and the molecule that binds to it stops oligodendrocytes from being able to produce, or precursor cells from being able to turn into myelin-producing cells. And there is an agent being tested in clinical trials, and there were some reports of this at the ECTRIMS meeting, that blocks this blocker. And that potentially could be an explanation for this difference between gray matter and white matter, and is a strategy that we're using based on that knowledge to potentially promote repair and remyelination in MS. And it's an agent that's being tested in phase two clinical trial for MS and for optic neuritis.
You know, I heard some people say that this is actually the first clinical trial, I guess, in phase two of a therapy that might be able to enhance remyelination. Is that correct? Is that right?
That's my understanding. That's as far as anybody knows. That's the first agent being tested that promotes repair.
Well, that's pretty exciting. So you've given me hope as I age that my brain is actually able to get better. Is that all that excited you at Ectrums?
So, no, again, on this theme of repair and remyelination, there were just numerous presentations on different strategies or concepts for promoting repair. So one that intrigued me, and I have to admit to being partially prejudiced for this approach because of my background in studying hormones and MS, but there were a number of groups, both academic research groups and company groups that are exploring the idea of agents that interact with estrogen receptor beta, again, on these OPC cells, and that interaction can promote their ability to turn into myelin-producing cells and repair myelin. So there was a presentation from a company we know called Endacy, which is one that's a company that's being supported by funds from Fast Forward, to investigate this approach, and there are other companies, interestingly enough, which makes me think that there's a lot of interest commercially in this approach of targeting ER beta to promote repair, and there are numerous academic groups, some of whom we're supporting. What's the gal at UCLA, Tim?
Rhonda Voskal.
T2R Woodruff and Rhonda Voskal, who has a clinical trial in estriol, and Seema T2R Woodruff, who's done some really elegant studies in animal models of MS, looking at the ability of these ER-beta compounds to promote remyelination, and really supports this potentially as a strategy for perhaps promoting repair in patients and MS people with MS someday. So I thought it was interesting that there were many different groups, both academic and industrial groups, that were interested in that estrogen receptor beta approach towards promoting repair.
Interesting. Well, another thing, though, I think I'm interested in your take on is, we a lot of times when we give updates on meetings, we're always talking about sort of the positive things, what's the good news stories that came out of this. I did hear that there's also some not so great news about a clinical trial that the society had supported, I think using a Lou Gehrig's drug. Do you remember the study that I'm talking about?
So
what happened
so this
there?
So this is the study that from UCSF that was led by Emmanuel Labonte, and they were studying a compound called riluzole, which has been tested in other neurodegenerative diseases before. And it is a marketed compound. I think it's for some gastrointestinal indication. And the concept was that this molecule could prevent damage to the nervous tissue. So this isn't necessarily a repair strategy, but a strategy that would prevent oxidative damage, other kinds of damage that occur during an MS attack on the nervous tissue itself. So Dr. Wilbon tested this idea in 35, I believe, patients with relapsing remitting disease, and the outcome was looking at an imaging, at looking at brain atrophy, I believe, was the outcome, which is shrinkage of the brain. So I'm the bearer of bad news in that all of us on this call, myself included, whether you live with MS or not, all our brains are shrinking. And however, in people living with MS, it looks like the brain shrinks a little bit faster. And so the outcome for this trial was looking at the rate of which the brain is shrinking. And unfortunately, what Dr. Wilbon saw was there really weren't any differences in people who were taking this medication in the rate at which their brain was shrinking compared to people who weren't taking it. So it was disappointing. I think it's a box that needs to be checked. I think that some of the limitations are that it was a fairly small trial. I don't think this necessarily closes the door on that agent or that approach in general for MS, but it's while disappointing, it is informative, both from that mechanism of action perspective and on the design, trial design.
So I want to pause now and ask for questions. I do, on when we come back from answering questions, I'm going to ask Bruce some more updates on, you know, there was some interesting stuff about, you know, genetics and risk factors, you know, things such as, you know, salt and its impact on MS. But before, you know, spending some time with Bruce talking about that, I want to pause now and see if there are any questions. So I'm going to ask, I think it's Chris, our operator, to get on the line and see if there are questions. For us.
At this time, I would like to remind everyone, if you would like to ask a question, press star, then the number one on your telephone keypad. We'll pause for just a moment to compile the Q&A roster. Again, you may press star one to ask a question. Your first question comes from the line of Jim.
Hello,
yes,
Jim.
How are you?
I'm good.
Good. Can you tell me if we, as the National Society, are we supporting financially research outside the U.S. When we learn about particularly attractive research, such as from this meeting?
Absolutely. So that's a great question, and it's one that, you know, we're actually very proud of, to give you the answer. You know, it has been a principle since Sylvia Lowry founded this organization many years ago that, you know, we would fund in a geographically agnostic manner. So we go where the best science is. And so we do have a very robust investment outside of the United States. Probably, I'd say roughly about, you know, not quite 10% of our annual portfolio, which this year would be about $5 million, goes to projects outside of the United States, mostly, I'd say, in Canada, UK, Europe, and Australia, where there are, you know, very, you know, hubs of MS research. You know, we've been funding some, you know, exciting research around nervous system repair and protection in the UK. We're partnering with colleagues in Australia, both around genetics and vitamin D projects, as well as studies developing new technology for measuring MS in people. So we are very committed to fund research outside the U.S. That being said, you know, I would also say the bulk of our research funding still is within the United States, largely because that's where, you know, the vast majority, I mean, there's a lot of MS researchers around the world, but I would say that, you know, there are many, many more research labs, you know, on a per capita basis here in the States than there are in other parts of the world, just on a per capita basis. And so, you know, we are the largest funder within the United States as well. But it is something that we, you know, we'll go wherever in a borderless manner, actually. So we're proud to do that. Thank you, Jim, for that question. Other questions for Bruce and I?
At this time, you have no further questions.
Okay. So coming back to ECTRIMS a little bit, Bruce, before we'll talk some more about our fellows program, you know, risk factors for MS is something that also came up a little at ECTRIMS. You know, I heard, you know, from some people at the meeting that, you know, things like smoking, vitamin D, even salt seem to all be factors that are weighing in MS. Any sort of updates for us from the meeting on those topics?
There was lots of studies looking at risk factors and interestingly how risk factors might interact with genetics of MS. I think one of the things that stood out for me would be just the now overwhelming evidence that links smoking
to increased risk for developing MS. And there were a few abstracts, a few presentations at the meeting related to smoking, one from a group in Sweden that showed in these countries like Sweden that have a state-sponsored healthcare can do these really great studies in large populations of people. And they showed in a presentation at ECTRIMS that cigarette smoking can increase the risk for developing MS at any age, no matter when they smoked. And it increased, it was a dose response depending on about for how long and how much they smoked. What's nice to know is that, like with the other things associated with smoking, that the risk factor that you get from smoking disappears within 10 years after stopping smoking. Another interesting study looked at the rate at which people who are taking the beta interferons for MS developing neutralizing antibodies. This is an immune response to the treatment that can prevent the treatment from working, and it's probably one of the reasons why interferons don't work in some people. And it looks like, or there's evidence presented at this meeting that smoking can increase the risk for developing these neutralizing antibodies. So smoking could potentially reduce the ability of some treatments for MS from working. So another reason among many that smoking not only as a risk factor, but as a factor that could perhaps prevent or inhibit the ability of some of the MS treatments from working, another good reason to stop smoking. The salt story continues to be interesting. Just as a real quick recap, there were a series of papers that were published in high-profile journals, I think Science and Nature, some months ago, that showed that feeding mice adults that diets that were high in salt could promote the kind of immune response that's thought to be responsible for MS and could make an MS-like disease in those mice much worse. They also went on to demonstrate that that high salt could, in cultured human cells, promote the kind of immune response that is thought to be responsible for MS. So there continues to be more research done on that. Some of the identifying some of the molecular triggers for salt in immune cells it continues to be interesting from a very geeky science point of view, and for identifying potentially targets for interventions that could be promising for MS. I think one of the stories that came out of the ECTRIMS meeting that I thought was really interesting was that a lot of that exploration of salt was done based on speculation that MS is more common in Western cultures where there are more, you know, diets are richer in prepared foods and higher in salt, and there wasn't a lot of science behind the diet part of that. And there was a study presented at ECTRIMS, actually from a group, a collaboration between a group in Argentina and in Boston, that actually did a population-based study and found that the rate of MS exacerbations was higher in people that had higher salt diets. So that was kind of the first, say, population-based sort of study directly linking and providing some evidence for that salt story, that the idea that high dietary salt could promote MS-causing immune responses. And I'm aware of several others. It's quite an obvious study to do, but now that we have the information, to do these kind of public health type studies to explore that connection between the salt and the diet and MS. And I'm sure at the next ECTRIM meetings, we're going to hear a lot more about that.
Great. Before I shift gears, we're going to talk a little bit about our fellow program. One of the things that I was excited about also at the meeting, and, you know, I think you'll be certainly please comment, Bruce, is, you know, we're all tracking a lot on this issue of vitamin D and how do vitamin D levels, you know, appear to influence whether or not you get the disease or also influence progression. And there was some studies, again, looking at people who'd been part of several large clinical trials that you know, discovered that, you know, if a person had low vitamin D levels in their blood serum at diagnosis and starting their therapy, they actually had more relapses than people who had higher vitamin D levels at the diagnosis time. And the other thing they found is that the people that had higher vitamin D levels progressed at a slower rate than the people who had low vitamin D. So it is, you know, another piece of evidence to suggest that vitamin D has an important role and that could affect, you know, a person's relapse rate and progression. And so I think we're going to continue to have to explore that in a bit more depth. So
yeah, and I also learned, I mean, in addition to the study that we're helping to support based at Johns Hopkins, the Ellen Mowry study, there are two other interventional vitamin D studies taking place in Europe, and I didn't know that until this, you know, till the meeting. They're fairly large studies testing different doses, but interventional studies that will help all in combination between Ellen's study and these studies really give us an idea of whether intervening with vitamin D is going to be a good strategy or not for MS.
Indeed. You know what? I realized one thing that I forgot to talk about. So was there anything going on about progressive MS at this meeting?
Well, there were lots of presentations. I think, you know, approaching 100 different presentations focused on understanding progressive MS. Again, my focus really was on how these repair strategies could potentially be treatments for progressive disease. I think there were other presentations looking at various aspects of neuroprotection. I thought a couple of things that struck my interest was studies on functions of mitochondria. So these are the little organelles inside of our cells that are responsible for producing energy. And one theory for progressive MS is that these little powerhouses inside of the nervous system cells and the neurons and axons wear out because they're working overtime to help keep the cell functioning in the absence of myelin. So there was an interesting study from a group in Germany that had a really cool technology. So this is a cool, imaging technology for looking at how these mitochondria are functioning inside of the cells and showed some evidence that, some interesting evidence for pathways that were disrupted and strategies for potentially overcoming that. The other thing that I thought was really interesting was this study on iron deposits. So this is from a research team that we know well in Austria, directed by Hans Lotzmann, it's an interesting phenomena. So you have a lot of different enzymes inside of cells in your nervous system that use iron as a cofactor. And when those cells become damaged, they release the iron. And that iron acts with other components in that mix to cause oxidative damage to other cells. And so this was kind of more of an imaging study looking at iron being deposited in the brain of people with MS, and they showed that there was this iron being deposited and it was being picked up by other brain cells, and that it's likely one of the causes of oxidative damage. And being able to develop strategies for stopping that iron or stopping the mechanisms by which it causes oxidative damage would be a really interesting potential strategy for slowing down progression. I guess one other study, and you need to stop me, Tim, if I'm geeking out too much here.
Keep on going.
Another one that I thought was really interesting was recently, scientists have noticed in the brains of people with progressive disease an immune response within or just outside of the nervous system that seems to be predominated by B lymphocytes. So you may remember that the main white blood cell that's thought to promote relapsing remitting MS is a T lymphocyte. These B lymphocytes seem to form just outside of the nervous system in the connective tissue called the meninges, And no one really knows what they're doing there in progressive MS. But one theory is that they're producing toxic factors that could be toxic to the nervous system. So this is a study that was performed by Bob Lisak, who we know at Wayne State University, and Amit Bar-Or, who's at McGill University in Montreal. And so they took these B cells from people with MS, and they showed in lab dishes that they produced toxic substances, whereas B cells from people that didn't have MS didn't seem to produce these toxic substances. So that's a clue that these B cells that are in this connective tissue just outside of the nervous system but are in close proximity to it might actually be producing something negatively that affects progressive disease. So that might mean that some of the treatments that are being developed now for MS that target B cells for other reasons, might also help in progressive MS by clearing out these B cells close to the nervous system producing toxic substances. I know some of these anti-B cell agents are being tested in progressive MS. It'll be really interesting to see how they work.
Excellent. Well, thank you. As you all can see on this call, I mean, there's just so much that happens at meetings like this, and Bruce and I could go on for hours and hours. But I do want to just shift the focus just a little. Meetings like this are also really important because they bring together talent. Scientists, senior scientists that presented these meetings at one point were junior scientists, which we call fellows. One of the things about, being a researcher is that, it is almost an apprenticeship. You get your advanced degree, whether it's a PhD, an MD, or some doctoral degree, and, you do a lot of research, and it doesn't stop there. You have to go on and do more training to get ready to become somebody who runs a laboratory. And that sort of, that second training period is called a fellowship. And one of the things the society has had for a number of years is a funding program to support fellows and to support their training to become scientists. And the training is done under the mentorship of another senior scientist. Both Bruce and I are actually alumni of the Society's fellowship program. I think Bruce and I had our fellowships about a year apart. I trained with Dr. Brian Popko at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill at the time. I think, Bruce, you were with Dennis Bordet, is that correct, at OHSU?
That's right, and I just want to make sure I point out that I'm the younger of the two.
He is the younger of the two, as he likes to remind me, and has more hair to show it, too. I think one of the things, though, that we wanted to share is that the fellowship program is really important at attracting the best and the brightest young minds. And one of the things we started doing recently was also getting our fellows together just about every other year at the Tykeson Fellows Conference. And, Bruce, I wonder if you could just share a little bit with our listeners about the Tykeson Fellows Conference and some of what's going to be happening there.
Yeah, I'd be happy to. So this is the fourth, I believe the meeting occurs every other year. But it's the fourth Tykeson's Fellowship Conference. It's taking place in Denver overlapping with the National Conference, and that was at the first week in November. It will bring together about 120 of our fellows, and also will be including some of the fellows from the Multiple Sclerosis International Federation be coming over to us from Europe as well for this meeting. That is a 2.5-day meeting that brings together all our fellows, and everyone, all of the fellows are asked to and do present either orally by a presentation or in a poster form an update of the science that they're working on. And in addition to these 120 or so fellows that will be attending the meeting, we've recruited about a dozen senior, well-known scientists to give talks about their research and then provide a number of opportunities during the course of this 2.5 days for the fellows to interact with each other, for the fellows to interact with the senior scientists. This is a meeting where a lot of information is exchanged, collaborations developed, relationships between fellows that last a lifetime that will ultimately result in collaborations and knowledge that would never have occurred otherwise. And that mentorship between a senior scientist and our fellows is an invaluable opportunity for them to interact with what sometimes I refer to as my heroes. I was fortunate enough to give a talk at a meeting a few weeks ago with some of my heroes that I, you know, I guess if scientists had trading cards, you know, these would be the guys on the trading cards. And that's really a great opportunity for our fellows to interact with some of these thought leaders in MS research as well as with themselves. And the agenda looks fantastic. I'm myself looking very much forward to listening to the talks, both from the fellows, from the senior scientists. I understand there will also be time built into the schedule for those that are attending the national conference for there to be time to interact with the fellows at their posters and over the course of meals and things of that nature.
Thank you, Bruce. It is really an exciting time for us. And, you know, we do this. I mean, it's a significant investment on the part of the society, but one that we're proud to do because, you know, this talent pool has such incredible impact. But one of the things that people may not know is that the society's trained over 800 scientists up to this point, you know, which is a lot of people. And so I think that, you know, we're really proud to have had that kind of an impact on the MS field. I do want to share a story about one of our fellows who was recently honored, Dr. Jonah Chan, who was this year's winner, actually, of the Barantic Prize for Innovation in MS Research. It's a $100,000 cash prize that the investigator can do anything they want with. But what was so remarkable about Jonah's work is that he was recognized for being innovative and coming up with a technology that allows us to find FDA-approved drugs that can be used to potentially promote repair in the nervous system. And now he's taken that technology, he's applied it, and actually has identified a drug that they're going to start clinical trials on probably within the next 3 to 4 months. To do the first initial validation. And it's just a great example of how an incredibly smart young talent, you know, has now had a chance to have impact. And, you know, as Bruce said, so many of our fellows have gone on to basically make significant contributions to MS research, and all because of the support and generosity of so many of our donors. I do want to pause here and see if there are any questions that folks might have for Bruce and I on any topic, actually, not just ECTRIMS, but on anything that's on your mind about MS research. So why don't we stop here and ask Chris if there's any questions from the audience.
Again, if you would like to ask a question, press star, then the number 1 on your telephone keypad. Your first question comes from the line of Michael.
Hello, it's Mike Bogdanoff, and my question pertains to the study regarding the impact of iron and MS. I recall that iron was one of the primary issues involving the CCSVI, in other words, that the lack of appropriate drainage of blood from the brain resulted in iron deposits in the brain that caused MS exacerbation. I know that there's been recent CCSVI-related research released from the MS Society of both the U.S. and Canada. I wondered if you could comment on the relationship, if any, to those studies.
Thank you, Mike. Bruce, care to comment?
Yeah, no, there was no, in this study that I mentioned that was presented at ECTRIMS, there was no evaluation of the blood supply to the nervous system, and it wasn't any attempt to make that connection between this CCSVI phenomena and this iron deposition in the nervous system. I can briefly comment on the CCSVI, and Tim probably could do a better job than me in general, but there have been many, many studies now examining this phenomena, and I think the jury still is out to some degree. A lot of these studies are conflicting, and we're still learning to what degree this phenomenon may or may not be involved in MS.
Yeah, no, I would agree. I think it's hard to tell. There's no question that these sort of iron deposits, probably are being harmful. Whether or not, it's due to, blood flow, I think is unlikely. It's probably some other sort of pathology that's going along with this, Mike. And so I suspect this is not so much related to CCSVI, but some other aspect. I think the challenge is that, in the instance of the studies that Bruce is alluding to, these are autopsy studies, I believe. And so as a result, there wasn't really a way to go back and see, is there some sort of, blood flow issue. But I suspect,
right, that's correct, yeah.
Yeah, and so I suspect, probably the preponderance of the evidence, and you're the attorney, but I'm not, but I'd say the preponderance of the evidence is that it probably, the issue here that they found in the iron studies is not really related to blood flow, but to some other sort of pathology that's going on.
Right, and remember, these iron is a cofactor for a lot of different enzymes, and I think it's when the cells, one theory is when some of the cells get damaged in the nervous system, these enzymes are released and their iron is released, and it's sort of like a building on itself. And as iron gets released, it causes oxidative damage to other cells, releasing more iron, and it just, I think that's the theory that this group is working from.
Thank you, Mike, for that question. Operator, our next question, please.
Your next question comes from the line of Robert.
Hello, Robert.
Hi, it's actually Robin. How you doing?
Hi. Hey, Robin. How are you?
I'm good. I was a few moments late getting on, but I love to hear these conversations. So you're just talking about the number of how many research fellows have gone through the program. I was curious as to how many have stayed as MS neurologists and stayed in the MS field, first of all, and how do we attract and recruit more into this research fellowship?
Great question, and I can tell you that we know those numbers because we approach this almost like an alumni program where we look back and go back to all of our fellows and say what are you doing these days, what are you working on. Last time we looked, close to 70% of the people that we trained were in some form of MS research.
Great.
When you think about that, that's an impressive number, and some of them have been involved in research for MS research for decades. Dr. Barry Arneson, who is a well-known neurologist, for example, at Chicago, University of Chicago. He got a fellowship from us in the late 60s, and it still involves seeing patients. And in fact, some of the docs at Chicago will tell you he sees more patients than some of the younger neurologists. So, what our data shows is that if we could hook a person in to MS, they stay. One of the things that we're starting to grapple with now, though, is that hooking them is no longer just enough because of all of the strains associated with, federal investments in medical research. There's more and more competition for, a smaller pie of medical research dollars. And so, one of the things we're now having to do is look at, how do we sustain these young investigators? So we get them in as fellows, but then how do we make sure that there's programs available to support their research when they become an assistant professor, for example, or when they go to the next stage and become the associate professor? Because the last thing we want is to bring people in, train them, and then say, hey, go off and, be successful. It's a very challenging environment to be a young researcher these days. And so earlier today, there was a discussion about this at the Society's Research Programs Advisory Committee, which is a group of senior physicians and researchers and other volunteers that Mike Bogdanoff is on, who are really talking about how do we sustain the talent pipeline, because many of the usual tools that were available to us as an organization of investment by the National Institutes of Health and others are becoming less and less reliable as a venue for young scientists to go to for funding for their research. And so it is one of the challenges we face in order to sustain all this great innovation that Bruce is talking about. Thank you, Robin, for that great question.
That's great. Can I ask one follow-up question?
Absolutely.
Of all the research that we're seeing or what is being proposed to us, what percent of everything that's being proposed are we able to fund now nationally and internationally? So with that $40 million this year, what did that fund percentage-wise of what was proposed?
Bruce, remind me, I think we were coming in around 20 to 25%, if I recall, or was it closer to 30%?
Yeah, that sounds – I think it's around 25%.
Yeah.
Of the total applications – are considered meritorious and funded.
And I think as a reference point, Robin, to keep this, so we're basically what we're saying is that you have about a 1 in 4 chance of getting funded by the SUD being found scientifically meritorious for funding. You know, at the federal level, because of the shrinking pie and the massive numbers of other researchers involved. I mean, now it's, you know, what's it, Bruce, like 10% chance?
It's less than that. It's single digits for most of the institutes now. It's 8-9%.
Exactly. So imagine that, you know, you're a young researcher, you're putting your grants into the National Institutes of Health and us, and, you know, you've got a 1 in 10 chance that your grant's going to get funded. And, that's the lifeblood of how we do medical research in this country.
Yep.
And that's why the society, you know, our commitment to both increase our – to increase the amount of money we put to research is so important because, you know, we're really filling a gap that is really being, you know, created by, you know, circumstances that are really somewhat out of our hands at one level, but does feed into our advocacy agenda to really continue to, you know, to sustain medical research because, you know, one of the things we're finding is that, you know, medical research is one of those things, you know, you don't just start it up immediately. I mean, if you shutter the labs, they don't get restarted quickly. And so we're working closely with our advocacy team to really think about how we can sustain and grow NIH funding, but also look at other avenues like the Department of Defense and the like to really create new opportunities. So thank you, Robin. Great questions as always.
Great. Thank you both very much.
Certainly. Operator, our next question, please.
Your next question comes from the line of Laura.
Hello, Laura.
Hello, Tim. It's Laura Vaccaro in the South Central chapter. How are you?
I am great, Laura. Great to speak with you.
Thank you all so much for the call. It's been really informative. I was just wondering what's new on the drug therapy front, what we should expect coming down the pike or what's in final clinical trials.
Sure. Those are great questions. So a couple things. One is at ECTRIMS, there was a report, an exciting report, with the therapy known as Aubagio, which is one of the new pills that was approved. They did a clinical trial with Aubagio where they gave it to people that had experienced what they call clinically isolated syndrome. And it's a long description for, let's say you wake up one day, you can't see out of one eye, you go see your neurologist, he thinks that it might be MS, not sure, but the way we diagnose MS, you know, they may have you wait for a little while because, you know, you haven't had any other neurological symptoms. So they took a bunch of patients that had been diagnosed as CIS, and most of the time people who are CIS, as we call it, will convert to definite MS. But what they wanted to see was, does the drug slow down the rate at which a person goes from being clinically isolated to having definite MS? And what they found was that this therapy reduced that rate by about 42%. So it was a big, big step. Now, these people still got diagnosed with MS, but, you know, imagine, you know, it gave, you know, months, if not longer, between symptoms, which, you know, when we understand the disease, you know, the fewer relapses a person can experience, the better. The other thing that's coming down the pipeline is, you know, we know that the FDA is going to be considering a new drug called Lemtrada. Some people might know it as Campath, which is a very powerful drug that basically reboots the immune system in people who live with MS. It's a big hammer, as my friend Dr. Larry Stein would call it, for really stopping the disease in its tracks. It has, you know, some, you know, side effects that may not be so great, so people have to be monitored quite a bit. But this drug is being considered by the FDA. It was already approved in Europe, and so later this next month, the FDA is considering it. And then lastly, we did hear some updates on clinical trials that are going on for new therapies that are targeting B cells. They're the ones that Bruce alluded to. It would be a new type of therapy, and so some clinical trials have started on that, and we should be getting the readouts from those sometime later next year, possibly at the next ECTRIMS meeting, or which actually is happening in Boston, so it's coming to the United States next year, and perhaps even before that. So there's a steady pipeline coming, and so we're optimistic that people with MS, at least for lasting MS, are going to have some more options. We still need to do a whole lot more on progressive MS, and you know, the Novartis is doing a clinical trial of Gilenya in people who have primary progressive MS, and I believe Biogenetic is doing a trial of Tysabri in people who have secondary progressive MS. So we need to do more on the progressive front, but there is a steady dose of lots of drug treatment studies happening. Thank you for your question.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Your next question. Sorry?
Go ahead, operator.
Your next question comes from the line of Carrie.
Hello, Carrie.
Hi, good afternoon. Thank you for taking the time to talk to us today. I'm curious about how an adherence to a strict anti-inflammatory diet could improve patients living with chronic progressive multiple sclerosis, because there are so few drugs out there that address it. And with the studies you've mentioned regarding salt and vitamin D, it makes me curious to know if there's been any research done on following people over time who really adhere to a diet that is anti-inflammatory.
No, that's a great question, Gary. And I think that this is one of the emerging areas that, you know, Bruce and I talk about it quite frequently, that, you know, we're increasingly seeing that diet and dietary factors can influence the disease, and sometimes can influence even people's responsiveness to the therapies that they're taking. And so we're now starting to try to come to grips with it. There haven't been, I do have to say, there haven't been a large number of consistent studies to look at this, because, you know, people look at it all their own ways. And so one of the things that Bruce and I and our research team are really starting to grapple with is, if you were going to explore and do a deeper dive into some research in this area, you know, what would be the questions? How would you follow people? What would be the, you know, how would you know that you're having an impact? Because we want to do it in a systematic and consistent manner. And there's a lot of, you know, I think I talk to many people with MS who'll say, you know, changing my diet, getting healthier, getting more physically fit really made a difference. And, you know, one of the things that you run into as a scientist that Bruce and I will say is, that's, you know, a challenge, because, you know, which is it? Is it just the diet that had the effect, or was it the exercise that had the effect, or was it the combination of those two that made a difference? And
right.
So as scientists, we're trying to sort of tease out, you know, which pieces of it, or it's probably a combination of all of them, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're trying to dig into that because there's just so much now, you know, data that's coming in from lots of different people's experiences to say that this is an issue we got to look at deeper, and really try to help the scientific community figure out where are the questions and what are the pieces we need to look at. Bruce, I don't know if you had any questions, and then this will have to be the last question as well. So, Bruce, any additional comment on the diet?
No, other to say that they're just really challenging from a study design point of view to implement. And I think that's really why we don't have good data right now. So I think we have to put some energy into how to basically what Tim said, how to design the trial, what outcomes we're going to measure, to make sure we do it in a scientifically valid way so that we're confident in the results. So that, I think, is where our energy needs to go right now, is sort of developing the trial design and outcomes measurement. And I know it sounds a little gobbledygookish, but those are critically important elements to make sure that we are getting valid results out at the end.
Absolutely.
Well, thank you, Carrie. I'm afraid that has to be our last question. I thank you all for your interest, and I'll turn it back to Heather.
Great. Thank you, Tim. And thank you, Bruce, as well, for taking the time to join us today for it's clear that your plates are overflowing with all these fascinating and critically important research activities. So we appreciate your time. And I'm sure I speak for all of our participants when I say that we appreciate you sharing such a comprehensive and encouraging update on the significant progress being made in MS research. So thank you both again. Before we close the call, I'd like to first just encourage everyone to please visit the Society's website, where you can find a link to our blog on the upper right-hand corner, where you can read all of the incredibly insightful and inspiring blogs that Tim had mentioned earlier in the call that came out of our recent ECTRIMS meeting earlier this month. And secondly, I'd like to remind everyone of a couple of exciting research engagement opportunities that are soon approaching, the first of which is the Society's Leadership Conference, which Bruce and Tip mentioned. The Tyxens Conference will be taking place in conjunction with the Leadership Conference, so it'll really provide many opportunities for Leadership Conference participants to engage with these fellows and encourage their work. In fact, we'll also be hosting a special fellows dinner the first night of the conference on Thursday evening for an exclusive group of special society supporters like yourselves, where you'll be able to dine alongside a select group of fellows and senior scientists, including Dr. Jonah Chan, our Brantzig Prize winner, as was mentioned earlier in the call, and Dr. Bruce Trapp, a world-renowned MS researcher in the area of nerve and myelin repair. So that's we're really looking forward to that opportunity. And lastly, I'd like to let everyone know that mark their calendars for December 5th, where we'll be hosting a live year-end webcast. This webcast will be a meet the press style panel that will focus on the promising research underway to protect, repair, and restore function in the central nervous system and what that means for people living with MS. The panel will feature Dr. Ben Behrs, chair of the neurobiology department at Stanford University School of Medicine, Dr. Jonah Chan, a neurologist at UCSF, who is also our inaugural winner of the Brantzig Prize, and Dr. Rhonda Voskuhl, the professor of neurology and director of the MS programs at UCLA, and Dr. Tim Kutze, of course, will be joining them. So again, I want to thank all of our participants for joining us today. Your generous support to drive this important research forward is clearly helping us make important strides towards stopping, restoring, and ending MS forever. So on behalf of everyone living with MS, we thank you so much. This concludes today's presentation, so thank you and have a wonderful rest of your day.
Ladies and gentlemen, this concludes today's Society Research Updates call. You may now disconnect.